podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com. The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. We're here again. It's a relatively quiet time in the snooker world. Northern Ireland Open qualifiers have been on this week. By the time you hear this, they'll be over. And then there'll be very little happening until the mixed doubles and the British Open. But we're not going to go on about that again. I spoke about that last week. There is other action going on. And we must say congratulations to Liam Davis from Wales, who has completed a remarkable treble in the IBSF World Junior events. He's won all three of them. He's won the World Under-16s, the World Under-18s, and the World Under-21s. So what an extraordinary achievement to win all three. It's never happened before. Clearly a great talent, and of course we saw him, he played in the World Championship qualifying last season. Very, very talented young man from a hotbed, of course, in Wales. My only hope, really, for him is that people don't put too much pressure on him. We don't want to hear he's a definite future world champion and all that stuff. None of that stuff ever helps, particularly for a young lad who, you know, is already excited about potentially turning professional. Just let him develop at his own pace. But clearly he's one to watch. Another young Welsh player, Dylan Emery's on at the moment, and he's doing pretty well so far. And Jackson Page, of course, got to the second round at the Crucible. So it seems Welsh snooker, you know, people say, oh, there's no young talent coming through. Not true, clearly there is. And Liam Davis, he's clearly one to watch. But as I say, let's not put too much pressure on him by getting in his ear about what he's going to achieve, because ultimately that is going to be up to him. But clearly, one to watch. And also, what's happening at the moment in Seattle, the US Women's Open is taking place. First big women's event in America, in the Ox Billiards Club, which looks a fantastic place. I know Judd Trump did an exhibition there. And it's happening now. They are actually streaming it. I believe our dear friend David Burney, he's doing some commentary. And another friend of the podcast, Matt Hewitt, is over there as well, the media officer for Women's World Snooker. So that's great. They've got some sponsorship from Microsoft. And, you know, it's a great thing, I think, to have an international event somewhere like America. We'd love a professional tournament there at some point, of course. Now, it's been a bumper week for emails. I'll rephrase that. We've had three. So it's not, but they're all crackers, actually. They're all really good. And we start David Grace, snooker professional. Now, last week, the aforementioned David Burney wrote in about essentially brushing tables and what the correct procedure was. And I offered no help at all because it's not an area of my expertise, like most areas. But anyway, David Grace, of course, from the Northern Snooker Centre as well, he's well-versed in all this. So he's actually answered some of these points that David made, and I'm just going to read them out here. So one of the questions that David asked was, in terms of brushing, do you brush after every session? David Grace says, I won't try and impersonate David because that would be offensive, but he says, once a day is sufficient for a club table. At tour events, the tables are cleaned after every match and also at the interval in longer matches. Next question, do we brush in one long sweep down the table or multiple overlapping little sweeps? David writes, ideally the latter followed by the former is what the table fitters on tour do. So the latter would be multiple overlapping little sweeps, and the former is one long sweep down the table. Next question. As well, have you heard to brush the table from the top to the bulk every once in a while, as long as you have a blocker to push down the nap afterwards? David writes, I can't see how this would benefit the table in any way. You should always brush in the direction of the nap, bulk to black end. Next question. How often do you block the table? What is a blocker? David writes, a block is just a piece of wood covered with baize, snooker cloth. It's used to settle the nap of the cloth after brushing. Always block from bulk to black end. next question. See how helpful this is? This is like Citizens Advice Bureau. You know, so at last, after 7 years, we're doing something useful. Anyway, it continues. How often should you iron the table? David writes, this depends on usage and how long the cloth will be on any given table. Ironing will settle the nap further still and should make the table run faster. But over time, ironing can wear out the cloth faster, in my opinion. Penultimate question, if you didn't have a snooker table iron, can you use a household one? And if so, what setting would you put it at? I heard wool is the best setting, but am I wrong? Is there a better setting for a household iron? And David writes, I wouldn't recommend a household iron, mainly because of the steam. Any moisture is bad for the cloth. The final question, how often should you vacuum a table? Would doing too much vacuuming pull the cloth off the slate? As well, what's the best attachment for a vacuum to clean the tables? And David Grace replies to that, again, not recommended. If you brush daily, including under the cushions, that should be sufficient. He says, I hope this helps. Well, it certainly does. I mean, what a player there, literally a player, but what a great thing to do to answer David's question. So hopefully that's helpful, not only to David Burney, but anyone else who's looking to learn about the upkeep of a table. We move on. Dave Tindall, who does a lot of heavy lifting, it's got to be said, on this podcast, and he's done some more here. Now, last week I mentioned the extraordinary revelation that Kirk Stevens and Belinda Carlisle share an actual birthday, not only the day, but the year as well. And Dave writes, after you revealed the extraordinary link between Kirk Stevens and Belinda Carlisle in last week's podcast, I inevitably disappeared down a rabbit hole looking at when snooker players and singers shared the same birthday. I've come up for air now, and I thought I'd share. So we have. Okay, so these are the pop stars and snooker players who share a birthday. 13th of January, Suggs from Madness and Stephen Hendry. 5th of May, Adele and David Grace. You see, David Grace again, I get to mention. 7th of July, Ringo Starr and Billy Snanton. Together at last. 29th of August, Michael Jackson and Joe Swale. 26th of November, Tina Turner and Sanderson Lamb. 5th of December, Little Richard and Ronnie O'Sullivan. If we add in Belinda Carlisle and Kirk Stevens, we're close to having an eight-team lineup for a mythical pairs event. A couple of years ago, I'd have recreated it on my 6x3 table at home, but unfortunately, its legs are now more wobbly than Elvis Presley's. Talking of Elvis, he shares the same birthday as Marco Fu, so there we go, we have our eight teams. It's a great lineup, although you have to fill for Rodney Goggins, who has to settle for being first reserve, despite sharing a birthday with both Aretha Franklin and Elton John. Thank you, Dave. Well, yeah, I mean, the pairings there, I don't know. You look at those pairings, I mean, Little Richard and Ronnie O'Sullivan, there's a couple of eccentrics. Suggs and Stephen Hendry, that's quite a... I'd say Suggs has probably played a bit of snooker down the years. You could imagine him in his youth in snooker clubs, maybe. Michael Jackson and Joe Swale. I think Joe Swale would be doing the heavy lifting there. Tina Turner and Sanderson Lamb. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure snooker's featured much in Tina Turner's life. But anyway, that's the pairings. If that event, I say if it ever happens, of course, that's lunacy to suggest it would. But anyway, that thank you, Dave, for doing that research, which, as he pointed out at the end, took bloody ages to do. Now, it occurs to me, Blanche DuBois. Let's mention her. She's a character from Streetcar Named Desire by Tennessee Williams, and her famous line is that I've always depended on the kindness of strangers. Well, here on this podcast, I depend on the kindness of our regulars to email in, otherwise there's no show. And our next email is from James Cook, our friend in America, who writes this. Regarding the most recent podcast where you referenced the current fallow period for snooker events, it got me wondering, whose job is it to put the tournaments on? And related to that, can you clarify the roles of each of the organisations involved in the game? WST, WPBSA, Matchroom, etc. And where, if anywhere, do the Q Sports associations fit in? As ever, keep up the good podcast work. I hope the recent play, Banana Crabtree Simon performances went well. Well, they did. Thank you for mentioning that in Edinburgh. We had quite a nice evening with Alan McManus. Scott Donaldson came and the whole thing went quite well. So anyway, but on your substantive point, yeah, okay, it's a good point, this, because we hear a lot people say that World Snooker Tour are the governing body of snooker. They're not, actually. The WPBSA is the governing body, and they have the various governance roles in terms of keepers of the rules and regulations, the disciplinary side of snooker, the development of the game, grassroots, amateur snooker, is in their purview, if I can use that word. They do coaching, they bring on referees, all that sort of stuff. So the WPBSA is the governing body. However, they also have and this is where it gets a little complicated, the WPBSA have a stake in World Snooker Tour. World Snooker Tour is the commercial entity that is charged with exploiting the game's commercial rights. So they are the custodians of the rights, so they deal with broadcast contracts, they deal with sponsorship, and it is World Snooker Tour's job to put on tournaments. So they run the professional snooker tour. And they work with sometimes independent promoters, and they sanction events, but they are in charge of the professional tour and all the associated commercial rights. Now, where do Matchroom fit in? Well, World Snooker, it's World Snooker Limited. They are owned by a holding company called World Snooker Holding. There'll be questions on this at the end, so do follow it. Okay, so World Snooker Holding, essentially, they are controlled by Matchroom. Okay, so Matchroom control World Snooker Holding, who control World Snooker Limited. So it's a kind of Russian dolls thing. So Matchroom overall runs the sport, but within that, you have World Snooker Tour and you have the WPBSA as the governance side of it. And the WPBSA also owns a stake in World Snooker Holding. I don't know whether this is really easy to follow or impossible, but that's essentially it. So it's like a sort of pyramid. You have Matchroom as the overall company, and within that you have World Snooker Holding, and within that you have World Snooker Limited. Okay? And that is run essentially, the whole operation is run by Matchroom. So Barry Hearn essentially took over the game's commercial rights in 2010, and this new World Snooker Limited sort of side of things was formed. It's a separate entity from Matchroom, but it's at the same time owned by them. It's a strange relationship in some ways. It's a bit incestuous, I suppose, you have to say. It's funny, World Snooker put a tweet up this week saying something along the lines of that, you know, on the World Snooker Tour, you've got to remember you're part of a big family. And I thought, yeah, in a lot of people's cases, they're part of the same family, literally. But anyway, but that's it, essentially. So the WPBSA are the governance side. World Snooker Tour run the professional tour and the associated commercial rights. But within the sort of umbrella of it all, Matchroom Sport ultimately own World Snooker. It all kind of fits in together. And to be fair, it's a system that does actually work well. Jason Ferguson from the WPBSA, you know, he's very involved in actually sourcing places where there might be interest in tournaments, and goes out to do good work on that side of it. But ultimately, World Snooker Tour, as the name suggests, run the World Snooker Tour. This season, there are 16 world ranking events on the calendar as it stands right now. 13 of those are open to all tour players, and then there's three that are limited fields, the Players Series, 32, 16, 8, as people are aware, goes down on. So 16 events. Now, I say that because, you know, looking at some sort of publicity and some of the things players have been saying lately, you'd think we were down to sort of 7 or 8. 16 is still a lot, considering we've lost the 5 in China. Of course, there were 2 new ones added last season, the British Open and the Turkish Masters. Mark Allen did an interview with Phil Hague in the Metro, where he made some good points, I think, about the way the tour is sort of, the qualifiers are being stretched out, and things I've said before, they're being stretched out to make it look like there's more snooker than there actually is, which I think, and also he said that, you know, there's concern that the situation, which is fair enough, but he did make me laugh a little when he said that there's a concern that people are not happy, players are not happy. Well, listen, I've covered snooker for 25 years, and I can assure you, in all that time, players have never been happy. You go in the players' room, you know, you're complaining about, you know, we don't want to go to China, but now they're not going to China, they do want to go to China. They're not happy with the rankings, they're not happy with the prize money, they're not happy with the venues, they're not happy with the tables. You know, there's a long list of complaints, and I say that as a journalist, because that's the other room in the building where there's loads of moaning, the press room. But anyway, he did make some good points as well, I think, and I won't reheat what I said last week, but there is a sort of feeling that things have plateaued. It can go the other way, though. I know they're looking at a few places, Malta, Bulgaria, been mentioned as places where we could still have events this season. So all is not lost by any means. But anyway, that's that. Thank you to the emails. Now, we also had Kerry Richards, wrote in a few weeks ago, and it was one of the emails that fell by the wayside. I did attempt to find this, and indeed I did find it, so if you just bear with me. See, there's other podcasts these days, and they're very professional, but, you know, this ramshackle approach I think people enjoy. Yes, here we are. Now, I thought I'd read this out, actually, but from your email, Kerry, it seems I didn't. He writes, with reference to this season's calendar, it's very disappointing to note that for the first time ever, the Welsh Open will not be held in South Wales. The south of our country is the traditional player base for the game, and by definition, I'd argue, the supporter base too. Maybe it's my South Walian bias showing through, but along with a sizeable group of friends, I've attended the event for many years and always felt that due to the various venues used in Cardiff and Newport, with the ICC at the Celtic Manor this year being the best, it was a special tournament in its own right and always well supported. Reference to my email you kindly read out last year on tournament venue hotspots and cold spots, with nothing in Cheltenham again and never anything in around Bristol. South Wales must be one of the game's biggest traditional strongholds that's now furthest away from any tournament in Britain. I can speak for our group when saying we're gutted our annual pilgrimage to the Welsh Open won't be taking place next year, unlike World Snooker's schedule planners. Keep up the good work with the podcast. Well, of course, there is going to be something in Cheltenham. The World Grand Prix is going back there in January. I get your point. I mean, you know, the Welsh Open's always been very passionately supported in South Wales. Llandudno is a nice venue. It's a nice town. That's where it's going to be this season. I think ideally you'd have a tournament in Llandudno and one in South Wales. But I get your point. I'm not privy to the exact reasons it's left that part of the world. I imagine cost is one. I do think I think I'm right in saying Jason Ferguson may have been on Talking Snooker. I can't remember, but he did make the point that the ICC last year there was nothing else going on there. Whereas it's hard to, because it's a big place, it's hard to book it when there might be a concert there or something, when you can hear, you know, say the Red Hot Chili Peppers, to name a contemporary band, are playing in the next room. Clearly that's not ideal if you've got a snooker tournament on. So there are those sort of issues as well, but I mean, there are other venues where they could have it in South Wales. The Newport Centre, I believe, has been knocked down, Paul Collier was telling me. He got his COVID jab there, which was apt, really, because a lot of people got the needle there over the years. But the Newport Centre, Ronnie O'Sullivan's favourite venue in Wales. and host of many great matches and finals in the Welsh Open. But anyway, that's gone now. And I think the venue in Cardiff is being knocked down as well. They're looking at Swansea, I believe. They're looking at Swansea. So all is not lost in South Wales. But for this season, it will be in Llandudno. Now, as promised last week, the remainder of this podcast, I'm going to be looking at Steve Davis's 6 world titles, because I've already ranked Ronnie O'Sullivan 7 and Stephen Hendry 7, and I think it's only right that we now look at the man that came before them, who set the standards in the 1980s, Steve Davis. I have to say, this was the hardest of the three. Steve Davis broke through, of course, in the early 80s. He won the UK Championship, and he very quickly became the best thing the game had ever seen. Not only just his will to win, but his professionalism as well. He really changed snooker. He made it, you know, it's rightly said that Alex Higgins brought a working class audience to snooker. That's true. But Steve Davis brought a middle class audience, because he was clean cut. Nans loved Steve Davis. You know, he was a nice boy, you know, doing a good job. He was someone to look up to. He was respectable. He brought respectability to snooker. And of course that brought a kind of respectable group of sponsors, brought money to the sport. It was something that respectable society suddenly liked, and families went and women went, and it became mainstream for that reason. It was no longer actually just a kind of, just a working class pursuit. It was something the whole country could enjoy. When I say whole country, I mean Britain, of course, at that time. But ranking Steve's wins, it was difficult. I mean, obviously the final he's most known for is the one he lost, I guess, 1985, because that's the most famous match ever. Here's the thing. Steve had very few close matches. You look back at the six world titles he won, there were no deciders. There were only a couple of matches that were, you could call close, i.e., you know, a couple of frames in it. He used to batter people, basically. That's the truth. He used to batter people. And for that reason, it's quite hard to pick between too much, but it's just a bit of fun, and you know we're not up before a jury. This is all just passing the time. So I have done my best to look through it all, and here we go. So we're going from 6 to 1. Number 6, I'm going to say 1984, and the reason for that is the one final that he ultimately won that he looked like he could lose. Of course, he had a big lead over Jimmy White, who was new on the scene, very exciting then. Led 16-12 in the final, Davis, only won 18-16, and Jimmy had a chance to level it up. That penultimate frame, well, actually, sorry, the last frame, I should say, was pretty close. So Steve Davis, that was one he could have lost, and of course, a year later he did. But, I mean, earlier in that tournament, he won 10-3, 13-5, 13-10 against Terry Griffiths. That was sort of the closest match on the way to the final, 16-9, so people didn't really threaten to beat him. Jimmy White could have done that year. It was a very exciting final. At the end of it, because it's all on YouTube, of course, now, MGT Snooker and these people, they put up these videos. Brilliant service. They do the game. And the original presentation is there. And at the end, David Vine is in the studio, I think certainly Willie Thorne's there, and I think John Spencer, maybe Rex Williams. Anyway, they sat there with a plate of sandwiches. Different times. And David Vine signs off saying, so this is 1984, okay? And he signs off saying, well, that was such an exciting final. Next year's will have to be something really special to beat it. Well, next year's is 1985, which of course was something special. Number 5, I've gone for 1988. He beat Terry Griffiths in the final. But again, on the way to the final, well, he won 10-8 first round against John Virgo. That's the closest anyone got to him. Then it was a 13-1 against Mike Hallett, 13-4 against Tony Drago. So a couple of real wallopings. In the semis, he beat Cliff Thorburn, 16-8. Against Terry in the final, it was interesting. He won the first session, 5-2, played 7 frames. And then Terry won the second session pretty comfortably. So it was 8-all overnight. And, of course, Davis has already lost, you know, a couple of finals that, you know, people sort of felt he was going to win. To Dennis Taylor and Joe Johnson. And he said that he got up early that morning. It would have been Bank Holiday Monday morning. And went for a walk around Sheffield to clear his head. And just kind of remind himself that actually he could play the game. That if he was feeling pressure, that was a good thing. Because it's a big match. And to just focus on the positives. And he did that. And he won pretty comfortably after that, 18-11. I mean, if you look at the second day, he actually wins that 10-3. So he sort of motored away. This was sort of in the middle of his imperious phase. 1988, he'd won the Masters, which was never a tournament he particularly targeted, because he targeted the ranking events, you know, face facts, triple crowners, but that's true. But he won the Masters that year. He did complete the triple crown, didn't he? Because he won the UK Championship in 87 at the end of that year, and then the Masters and the World. But he was winning so many tournaments. I think he won more tournaments in 88. Than any other year. I think I'm right in saying that. So, yeah, this was the time when he sort of bestrode the snooker world. And as I say, people just didn't get close to him. Fourth position, I've gone for 981. Obviously, this was the breakthrough winning the world championship. And the debut win, obviously, is always significant because until you win it the first time, you never know if you can. You look at his route to the final. It was very tough, actually. You had Jimmy White to qualify. Was that to qualify or was that first round? Anyway, I think that was first round, wasn't it? Maybe I should have looked this up beforehand. Yeah, first round he beat Jimmy White 10-8. Then he beat Alex Higgins 13-8, Terry Griffiths 13-9, Cliff Thorburn 16-10. So he's playing, you know, proper players in every round. But again, they didn't get close to him. Jimmy did in the first round. But after that, didn't get close to him. He led 6-0 against Doug Mountjoy in the final. And that lead, it was narrowed, but I think it went 12-10, but anyway, it stayed at the end, 6 frames, 18-12. Mountjoy was a very, very good player. Of course, already Masters and UK champion by that point. So Steve Davis, who'd already won the UK Championship, suddenly he was the new sort of British sporting superstar at that point. You know, snooker had made a big stride into the lives of the public on television, and he, as I say, was the perfect figure to take it forward. And what a gift, really, to the sport. So that was number 4. Number 3, I've gone for 1987. I think this was a significant win because, of course, he'd lost the previous two finals. He'd lost to Dennis, he'd lost to Joe, he played Joe again. And this was, got quite close this final. Davis led going into the last session 14-10. Joe won the first three frames. So now it's 14-13 and all the memories and all the sort of the bad memories really coming back to haunt him. But he pulled away again to win 18-14. It was a tough old match that. Joe pushed him. But again, no one else really pushed him. 10-7 round one. Then we had 13-4, 13-5, 16-11. So again, it's the same kind of pattern. No one really getting that close to him. But even so, Davis still had to get over the disappointments of the previous couple of years, and he did that in style. So we've got two left, and in number two, second position, I've gone for 1983. This was another walloping. It was a session to spare in the final, 18-6 against Cliff Thorburn. 10-4 round one, 13-11 Dennis Taylor. That was the closest anyone got to him in the second round. And then 13-5, 16-5 against Alex Higgins in the semis. Of course, Cliff had had the opposite. Cliff Thorburn had real close matches every round. He had three deciders in a row against Griffiths, Kirk Stevens, Tony Knowles. So obviously he was lacking a bit of energy. Even someone as determined as him was lacking a bit of energy. But again, it just underscored that Steve didn't just win these tournaments, he absolutely won them at a canter. And that is certainly true of the last world final, which is number one, of course, 1989. This is the last one he won. But my word, he won it in style. You look back at the matches again, they were all runaways. 10-5, 13-3, 13-3 again. So two sessions to spares in a row. 16-9 against Stephen Hendry in the semis. And then 18-3 against John Parra. Another session to spare final. So just a series of, you know, comfortable wins. He lost, 23 frames in the whole tournament. Amazing, really. And he was so dominant, particularly against a player like Parra, who, you know, was breaking through at that point. He won the European Open and he was breaking through as a top player. Hendry had already, you know, would won the Masters that year, and he beat him in the semis. Parrott, Jimmy White, of course, was very much at the top of his game around that point. He was beating these guys easily. And you thought, well, this is just going to carry on into the 90s. He could get to 10 world titles. But in fact, he was never in the final again. And interestingly, and Clive wrote about this at the time, interestingly, he was telling people privately, Steve, that he felt that his game actually was declining a little bit, and he was a little bit concerned that he'd lost a little bit of edge. Now, you look at those results, you think, how can you think that? But obviously, he would know better than anyone. And something maybe changed, I don't know. He'd equaled the Ray Reardon record at that point. We entered a new decade with a new champion in Stephen Hendry, and Davis got to certainly one more semi-final there. Possibly a couple, I think. But anyway, he started in the mid-90s to decline a little bit. And he had a few last hurrahs, including that win over John Higgins in 2010, which was incredible, very memorable. But 89 was his last win. But what a reign, what a reign. And anyway, that's my order of things. I'll repeat it for you. 6, 1984. 5, 1988. 4, 1981. 3, 1987. 2, 1983. And 1, 1989. That was the what seemed like the perfect set of results, but as I say, he didn't win it again after that. Of course, feel free to point out where the order is wrong and where how you would have it, and any comments on any of that, you're more than welcome to contact us, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. We should send our best wishes, by the way, to another multi-champion, Mark Selby, who has revealed that, and this is a becoming increasingly common problem, it seems, for snooker players. He's got neck trouble. Now, he's had this before, but he had a scan in the week, and he's got a bulging disc at the top of his spine. Ricky Walden had one, I think, at the base of his spine, which really affected him. Of course, Sean Murphy's had his problems, Anthony Hamilton. It can't be coincidence that these guys have spent, well, most of their lives basically bending over tables. It must have had an effect on their health. Obviously, Mark has had a great career and it's nowhere near over. So hopefully he can come through this and as the season continues, it's not as much of a problem. But he's having physio and, he was in trouble in Germany. He said he was in discomfort there. Hopefully that will be resolved and he can play pain-free, because we've seen, of course, Ricky Walden come through it, and he had a great season last season. And Sean Murphy as well seems to be certainly better than he was in terms of his health. Well, I think we'll wrap up there. There's no point pretending this has been a vintage episode. It hasn't been. But anyway, we've got through it. And we are proud members of the Sports Social Network. Check out the little podcast. I'm sure they're really happy to have us. And yes, as I say, you can contact us, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. Any issues that you feel should be discussed, well, now's your chance, because let's be honest, there's nothing happening right now. And it's a shame. I mean, one thing Mark Allen said, which again I agree with in that interview, was that this Six Reds business, I mean, that tournament is not happening, right? But it's still on the calendar. Players have not been told officially that it's off, even though it's supposed to start on September the 5th. So, you know, that's not great. It's only a week away. Tournament's not on. It might be on later, hopefully, in the season. But it's not going to be happening that week. Staff have been told, broadcasters have been told. So the players really should have been told officially. And it's little things like that. I can understand why that annoys players, because, you know, they're trying to manage their lives. You know, they're trying to manage, for example, if they've got to fly to Thailand for a week, they may have to arrange childcare. They may have to arrange other things in their life, because they're going to be away. Or there might be things they can do if they don't go away. So they might be able to book exhibitions. Some of the players that work as coaches now, they can arrange that. So this is why, you know, that their itineraries are important. And I do feel that that is an area that could be improved to a degree. We're living in uncertain times, and the World Snooker Tour calendar is not immune to that. This Hong Kong event, you know, is interesting because it's not a prototype, but it could be something that you could look at as a possible way of getting tournaments back safely in China. Obviously, it's only an 8-player event, so it's easier to handle. It is a little bit odd, though. They're playing in a bubble environment, so they've got to go to the hotel and then to the venue on a bus, and they can't kind of go anywhere else, and you know, they've got to stay in that bubble. But it was pointed out, and I do tend to agree with this, there's going to be a live audience of thousands of people. I mean, they're actually saying it could be the biggest ever audience. They're not in the bubble. So the players are in a big room full of thousands of people. That bubble, I understand why it's there. It seems to be for show more than anything. But I'm not quite sure what difference it's going to make, really, if you're letting in thousands of people who are not part of this. But anyway, glad the event's on. It should be really, really good. So there we are. This time next week, Liz Truss will be Prime Minister. What a time to be alive. What a time to be alive. Yeah, that's it. See you next week. For now, goodbye-bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.